From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
It's December 2001, and throughout the country, tens of thousands of women and children are being cut off of federal TANF assistance because they've met their five-year time limit, despite nowhere else to go.
As Congress offers billions in corporate welfare, as Laura Bush condemns the treatment of Afghan women, and as New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani lures tourists to New York by casting as a city of compassionate unity, we will speak with welfare activists. Suicide bombers kill 25 in Israel. Prime Minister Sharon is considering overthrowing Palestinian President Yasser Arafat, and feminist theologian Rifat Hassan on women and Islam as Afghan women struggle to gain a seat in the reconstructed government of Afghanistan. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. We broadcast just blocks from the first Ground Zero. Afghanistan is the second, but we turn now to Israel. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon held urgent talks with top ministers and security chiefs today to decide how to respond to Palestinian suicide attacks that killed at least 25 people and wounded about 200 over the weekend. Several cabinet ministers demanded that Israel expel Arafat, and reporters accompanying Sharon said he was weighing the proposal. There's no indication that President Bush is trying to persuade the Israeli leader to hold back. The Palestinian militant group Hamas claimed responsibility for all the attacks. Palestinian security forces arrested around 100 Hamas and other activists in the biggest sweep in 5 years. Israel today called the overnight sweep a charade aimed at preventing massive Israeli retaliation. Meanwhile, a Palestinian was killed in a firefight with Israeli troops in the West Bank late yesterday, and a Palestinian farmer was shot dead early today as he walked toward his field. We go now to Israel, to Jerusalem, to Michelle Warshavsky, former director of the Alternative Information Center, a joint Palestinian-Israeli group that disseminates critical information and progressive analysis on Israel-Palestine and the conflict. Your response to the situation at this point. It's good to have you with us.
Yeah, good evening. We are entering a new phase in the conflict between Israel and the Palestinian people, and which may have very severe repercussions. Everything has been tried by the various Israeli governments to try to stop the resistance of the Palestinian people against occupation. Every means, including state of siege, targeted assassinations, destruction of houses, entering the Palestinian, invading the Palestinian autonomous zones, but all these means have been unable to stop the resistance of the Palestinian people. So what is today the public discourse in Israel is not anymore to look for an efficient way to put an end to the resistance, but simply revenge. We have a discourse of revenge, not only in the streets, but also from very senior leaders in the Israeli establishment, including the Prime Minister.
Can you talk about the suicide bombing attacks on, what was it, mainly young people this weekend at Zion Square? Where is it? Can you place it for us?
The suicide bombings inside Jerusalem were at the heart of downtown, at the heart of the city, where young people, young Israelis and young foreigners also are spending their evenings where we have bars and cafe houses. In Tel Aviv, it was different. It was a bus coming from a quite popular neighborhood to downtown. And in both cases, the people who have been killed were normal civilians, which happened to be there at that moment.
And what do you see happening at this point? What exactly Sharon is going to do as he cuts short his trip here and heads back to Israel?
It seems that the target now, in order to give an impression, and not only an impression, but to respond to the demand from the far right and from part of public opinion to escalate, The next step in the escalation is to target the Palestinian Authority itself and Yasser Arafat, and to put an end to the Palestinian Authority as such. This seems to be the orientation of the present government, although there are voices essentially from the intelligence bodies and the Israeli secret services, which are warning not to take such a step, which will open the way, on the one hand, to chaos on the Palestinian side, if it will be successful, and on the other hand, definitely for a much more radical alternative.
We're also joined on the telephone, in addition to Michel Warshavsky, former director of the Alternative Information Center, Ahmad Jardat, who also works with that group and himself was imprisoned in the 1980s in Bethlehem. Right now, Arafat has had arrested over 100 Hamas activists. Israel is calling this biggest arrest in 5 years a charade. How significant do you think this sweep has been? Ahmad Jardat?
Hello.
Hi, can you hear me?
No, repeat the question, please.
How significant do you think the arrest of over 100 Hamas activists is? Israel is calling it a charade.
Yes, first of all, it's bitter to know that since the came of Zenit to the area, around 22 of Palestinians were died, 9 of them are children. This is, so the atmosphere or the what happened is become in the frame of escalation in the area. What happened today and last night that the PA arrested around 100 of the leaders and mid-leaders and activities in Hamas and the Jihad al-Islami. I think the way that they arrest them is serious one. This is, and they covered all the West Bank and Gaza Strip in this arrest. For example, 35 of the people who were arrested are from Gaza Strip. More than, according to the demands of the Israelis, or according to the claim of the Israelis, that Arafat didn't take a serious actions against these parties or these groups, it's not... so accepted, more than the arresting of the people, what Arafat is going to do. This is one. In addition to what's very important, Arafat can control the situation in two ways. If he had some achievements on the peace process itself, which is give the Palestinians the answer that Arafat or the PA bring something good for them. But in the frame of the closure, in the frame of the aggressions that the Israelians doing it by the time, this has put the PA in the crisis, especially to the people. So the demand from the PA to take these procedures against these parties, at the same time, there is no achievement on the peace process, and there is no things that they gave to Arafat, and they didn't implement what they already agreed before in Oslo or in White River and such that, or without implementing the Mitchell report or the or tenet agreement, it means the Israelis want from Arafat or from the PA to work with them against the Palestinians. This is one. PA left PA now in a very difficult situation. At the same time, the Israelis demanded from them to take more and more, and they didn't give. The Israelis didn't give the PA anything on the political level.
Finally, Michel Warshavsky, the killing, the Israeli assassination of Mahmoud Abu Hamoud, one of the leaders of Hamas. This happened before the suicide attacks. Do you think that the suicide attacks were retaliation for that?
Of course, I don't think. It's obvious that not only even Israeli official spokesperson don't hesitate to make a connection between the two. They knew very well when they decided to assassinate Abu Hamoud and other Hamas leaders that there will be retaliations, and it will be very tough retaliation. The warning was clear, and we know that Hamas always implement what they promised to do, and they did it. I don't know even if it's finished, because they promised to hit the three cities of Israel.
Well, right now we have word that helicopter gunships have just fired right near the house of Yasser Arafat, Israeli military helicopters.
Yeah. God help us, as you say, in the United States, because if really the Israeli government will succeed in assassinating assassinating President Arafat or finishing its power, and I remind that he has been elected by the great majority of the Palestinian population of the West Bank and Gaza, then the suffering will be big among the Palestinians, but it will be 10 times bigger for the Israeli population, and we will enter a long period of real hell.
Well, Michelle Orshovsky and Ahmad Jaradat, I want to thank you very much for joining us, speaking to us from Israel and the West Bank. You're listening to the War and Peace Report. Fanun music from the Palestinian Holy Land. You're listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we look at politics here in the United States, Congress spending billions or offering billions of dollars in corporate welfare to wealthy multinationals, Laura Bush condemning the brutal treatment of Afghan women, and New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani luring tourists to New York by casting it as a city of compassionate unity after September 11th. But politicians are overlooking a group of people, mostly women and children, who live in this country and who need assistance the most. At midnight on Friday night, tens of thousands of families in New York reached a five-year lifetime limit on federal welfare aid. They're by far the largest group yet to face the federal cutoff that's long loomed in the nation's welfare overhaul, and they're among the first to face it in a recession. New York's required by its constitution to aid the needy, and it's spread a state finance safety net to catch the estimated 40,000 families whose welfare grants were canceled over the weekend. But advocates say many recipients of welfare have been improperly severed from assistance because of bureaucratic bungling, if not deliberate intent, by the Giuliani administration. And in much of the country, there's no state safety net, leaving these families with no alternatives. We start with Liz Krueger, who is an anti-poverty advocate and former associate director of the Community Food Resources Center. She joins us in our firehouse studio. Congress is spending billions of dollars in the war on Afghanistan. What about poor people here?
Well, as we don't want the country to forget, over the last 5 years, the federal government dramatically reduced benefits for poor Americans. The 1996, quote, Welfare Reform Act cut billions of dollars of funding from poor Americans through cutting TANF, AFDC, the food stamp program, cutting eligibility for SSI and decreasing people's access to benefits. This time limit you mentioned now is to some degree the culmination of the decisions that were made in 96 to put a five-year lifetime maximum eligibility on federal cash assistance for families with children. These are typically women with an average of two children. So here in New York City, we're facing tens of thousands of people, actually 30,000 families, the estimate is, losing their benefits here in New York City. And that works out to be about 90,000 women and children alone just for New York.
What about how that compares to people around the country? I mean, the welfare cutoff is this weekend in New York. What about other places?
Well, because every state now controls its own program, it's very individual, state by state, county by county, as to what the responses are. part of the trick is that the timeline doesn't hit the same place everywhere because it depends on when your state implemented the federal law. So some states actually hit their time limits before us. Some states chose to have shorter time limits. The federal law was a maximum 5-year time limit. Some states chose as low as a 2-year maximum time limit. So they've actually been going through this for a while. I think some of the added problems from us here in New York, as we know right now, we're facing a very serious recession. We've lost tens of thousands of jobs in our economy just since September, actually over 100,000 jobs in our labor market here in New York City since September. And so at the same time as people are hitting their time limits, the options in the labor market are really not there for them. And the fact is, women and children throughout the United States who actually have stayed on public assistance or TANF for 5 years straight during, quote, the good economic times we were going through are by definition families who have multiple problems and barriers to being able to move into the labor market. So we're really hitting the most vulnerable families with this rule.
And again, explain TANF.
TANF is the federal program that replaced the old AFDC program. So we created in 96 through the Welfare Reform Act then something called the Needy Assistance for Families Program, TANF. It's a block grant program to states. It gave states enormous latitude in how they were going to operate their programs, but it did have very specific limits on it. And one was a 60-month lifetime limit for eligibility. So despite the fact that I might be a mother on TANF today who has a child with special needs, who's got my own medical problems, who's caring for an elderly adult who can't afford my rent and who really cannot move into the labor market, once I've hit my 60-month limit, the federal government will not assist me anymore.
We're also joined in the studio by Maribel Soto. She's an organizer for Families United for Racial and Economic Equality. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thank you.
Can you talk specifically about the women that you organize in your group?
Well, basically, most of them are reaching their time limits, have reached their time limits because of last weekend. And we have people going, they're practically losing their mind because they don't know where they're going. The unemployment has raised so high in New York City that there's basically no jobs. There's no jobs for the people that lost their jobs in the World Trade Center. So who's going to give a welfare recipient a job? Especially when the TANF didn't work. It just failed because it didn't educate people. It didn't give them the skills they needed to overcome poverty. It just held them in dead-end jobs with no way out. So if we don't give people the tools they need to overcome poverty, how could we expect them to go out there and get a job and sustain this job without that ability? It's a learning skill.
So what happens to someone who loses their welfare this past weekend?
Well, a lot of people have been denied the right to reapply for Safety Net, which is the state grant. And some people are just gotten cut off. I've gotten several calls from people that saying, well, I received a letter, they're cutting me off, but they never gave me the opportunity to reapply for Safety Net. I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to lose my apartment. Where are my children going to go?
And what does the city do if...
Well, this is what we're trying to figure out. What is the city going to do for all these millions of people that are going to stay homeless with no income? We're in Christmas. These kids are not getting no benefits on December. No food stamps. So how are these families going to feed their children? That's what I'm trying to figure out, and plenty of other people are trying to figure out, how are these people going to survive? Is it that the system is just planning to remove these children and make it worse for the families by taking these children away from them? Because now they can't support their families. They don't have no resources. And in the five years period, these families wasn't entitled to get education. They were dumped into dead-end jobs, cleaning streets, cleaning parks. These are not skills. Anybody has these skills. We all could go out there and clean up the street. But this is the only thing that was given to them.
That was offered to them before this weekend when they're totally cut off.
It was offered. A lot of people were offered a 515 job. Some people have five kids, three kids.
When you say 515 job, you mean $5.15 an hour.
$5.15 an hour. There's no way. You know, the rent is high.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves, but we're going to come back to this discussion. Maribel Soto with Families United for Racial and Economic Equality and Liz Krueger, anti-poverty advocate, former associate director of the Community Food Resources Center. And after that, we're going to go to an Afghan Women's Summit that was held in New York this past week and hear from a feminist theologian. Stay with us.
Something pretty bad has got a hold on me. Something pretty bad, people, has got a hold on me. About that place way across the sea.
Eric Burden and War. This is Homeland here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we broadcast just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood, our guests are Liz Krueger, anti-poverty activist, and Maribel Soto, organizer for Families United for Racial and Economic Equality, FURY, in New York City. And we're talking about tens of thousands of families here in New York alone reaching a five-year lifetime limit on federal welfare aid. They're by far the largest group yet to face the federal cutoff that's long loomed in the nation's welfare overhaul and among the first to face it in a recession. There is a safety net here, though, in New York that a lot of other states don't have.
Right. New York has a constitutional requirement to care for the needy. Most states do not have that language written into their state constitution. So as a result, we have a state program we're calling the Safety Net Program that people who time limit out of TANF but remain poor and meet eligibility should be able to continue to get benefits through the Safety Net Program. A big problem for us here in New York City is the fact that Mayor Giuliani made the decision that he didn't want to allow a seamless or simple transition from TANF to the Safety Net Program. He made the administrative decision that he wanted to continue his policies of making it extraordinarily difficult for people to get and stay on benefits even when they needed them. So he created a new system requiring people to go through a reapplication process at a separate office with a separate computer system. And of course, all this was happening post-September 11th, when the city's own computer systems were not working for an extended period of time because they're driven by phone lines that weren't working. So despite the fact that he knew he didn't have a system in place to have this happen correctly, he continued the policy. And so what we're hearing about and we're reading about in our newspapers is that thousands of families are falling off of benefits, are not being allowed to reapply, are being lost in this sort of traffic flow of complicated computer and paper requirements, and are even being misinformed when they go to try to apply for safety net that it's too late and that they can't apply. For people listening, it is not too late. Of course, you can always apply for benefits in New York if you're in need. The tough question is whether we're going to get you on them and whether we're going to get you on them in time for you to avoid facing, as our other guest was saying, facing holiday season without any rent money, without any food money, without health care for yourself and your children. And it's a very serious problem.
Maribel Soto, we have the situation where the Towers Fund, the Twin Towers Fund, where millions, half a billion was raised for the people who were affected by the World Center attack. They can't even get money for that. There's something like $250 million set aside, and they're not releasing it to families. And you're talking about another situation here in New York City. Some are going to be affected by both. What is the one recommendation you are making, the most important recommendation now you're making to affected people?
If they need help, they could always come to us and get the help they need. And we're there to support. We work with other organizations as a coalition to end poverty. You know, value of work is count. The value of work should count for everybody. And basically, these listening sessions are not listening to people. They have experts with PhD, but not experts that have lived in poverty. They need to listen to the people that are facing poverty. They want to implement marriage. People have to marry their spouse in order for you to be eligible. But if you're battered by this spouse, why you want to go back into a battered family? Why you want to bring your children into this statistics? There'll be only statistics. But these are what these so-called experts are talking about, how families should be a unit. But it can't be, because possibly if two individuals can't communicate, what should we force them to be together? So if they're talking, Laura Bush is talking about the Afghanistan women's, so they want to do the same thing to the women's in New York City and in our nation? So what are we supposed to walk outside, not be liberal? So the freedom we fought about in the 20s to get as women, they're going to take it away from us.
Well, on that note, it leads us perfectly into our next segment of the program. I want to thank you very much, Maribel Soto, for joining us from Families United for Racial and Economic Equality, its acronym FURI, and Liz Krueger, former associate director of the Community Food Resources Center in New York. And people can get contact information at our website, democracynow.org. You've been talking, you just made the connection to Afghan women, Laura Bush, condemning the brutal treatment of women in Afghanistan. Well, we're going to talk about the situation for women there. The Northern Alliance leader, Rabbani, who was Afghanistan's last president before the Taliban seized power, said yesterday his interim government in Kabul would allow a maximum of 200 United Nations peacekeepers to be stationed in the country. Rabbani insisted his party, the Jamiati Islami, was glad to send delegates to the conference in Bonn, even though, quote, we didn't have time to prepare fully. But he revealed differences with the other parties taking part in the conference. According to the roadmap towards a peaceful Afghanistan drawn up by the UN Special Representative, Lakhdar Brahimi, at the Bonn talks, an emergency Grand Assembly, or Loya Jirga, will lead on to an interim council and a constitutional assembly until Afghanistan has a new constitution, a broad-based government, and a national army. Well, leaders at the talks say the new government will be broadly based and representative of Afghanistan as a whole, including its women, and go to work immediately to manage Afghanistan and work with countries offering reconstruction aid. Women are fighting hard to be included in this new government. We're joined right now by videotape by Dr. Rifat Hassan. She's a feminist theologian at the University of Kentucky, and she spoke last week at a conference at the City University of New York about and on Afghan women. We're going to hear her address, Dr. Rifat Hassan.
I have been engaged for almost 3 decades of my life in developing the discipline of feminist theology in the context of Islam, and trying to educate Muslim women about their rights under Islam. There is, in the case of Islam, which like all the other major religious traditions of the world, developed in patriarchal cultures, a big gap between what are the normative teachings of Islam and what is actually happening to Muslim women in different cultures and societies. And highlighting this difference has been one of the quests and pursuits of my life in many countries of the world. This is just a little bit about where I'm coming from. The topic for this panel is the role of U.S. women's movement in supporting the Afghan women's struggle. But before I can really address the question of this question and talk about the struggle of Afghan women, I consider it necessary to contextualize this question in a broader framework. Because what happened on September 11, in my judgment, was a moment of historical discontinuity and rupture. I want to separate out the event that took place in the city and in Washington on that day. Muslims all over the world have been unanimous in condemning that act of violence, which is not justified with reference to anything in Islam at all. Leader after leader, scholar after scholar, person after person has said that. In the Quran it says, if you take one life unjustly, it is as if you have killed all humanity. If you save one life, it is as if you have saved all humanity. It puts an absolute value on every life. So I, for one, cannot imagine holding the position that the taking of so many innocent lives can be anything but a totally evil act, which must be condemned. And it has been condemned. Now, having said that, and I did want to make my position clear on that point, I would like to look at the larger picture that we are facing in the world today. From almost the very start of this unfortunate event, the problem has been posited in terms of absolute polarization, almost in terms of cosmic dualism, us versus them, whoever them they are, or whoever them is, and whoever us is, good versus evil. I think that this way of articulating the problem is exceedingly dangerous because it leaves no middle ground, and it divides the world into two absolutely polarized places. Everybody knows, at least I'm sure, that all the Muslims in the world know, and all the ones who are sitting here know, how much Islam and Muslims and Arabs have been stereotyped in this country and in the West. But I'm not sure that they know how long the stereotyping has been going on. It didn't start in 1973 with the Arab oil embargo. It didn't start in 1979 with the Iranian Revolution. It didn't start in 1989 with the Salman Rushdie crisis. It didn't start in 1990 with the Gulf War. It didn't start in 1993 with the first attack on the World Trade Center, although it was somewhat disconcerting to hear, to read in newspaper after newspaper, Muslim caught in Trade Center bombing. Whereas when Timothy McVeigh blew up the Oklahoma Center, not one newspaper said Christian caught in Oklahoma bombing. I mean, there are these things which, of course, Muslims are very sensitive to. The stereotyping of Islam and Muslims started in the 7th century, when Islam first appeared on the borders of Europe and was seen not only as the other, but as the adversary. And I think a very, very good depiction of that is that the Dante, the great poet of medieval Christianity, in his classic, The Divine Comedy, in which he depicts a journey through the spheres from the inferno, which is hell, through purgatory to paradise, puts the prophet of Islam amongst the worst sinners in hell. And he is shown as being split from head to foot. And I would like to have the liberty of quoting a few lines from this poem. A wine tun, when a stave or cant bar starts, does not split open as wide as one I saw, split from his chin to the mouth with which man farts. Between his legs, all of his red guts hung, with the heart, the lungs, the liver, the gallbladder, and the shriveled sack that passes shit to the bung. I stood and stared at him from the stone shelf. He noticed me, and opening his own breast, with both hands cried, "See how I rip myself. See how Muhammad's mangled and split open." This is an unforgettable description. And this was, Dante put the Prophet of Islam amongst the worst sinners in hell because the crime that he committed, according to Dante, was that he split the world of Christendom. That's why in the poem he's shown as split from head to foot with all of his inside hanging out. Thomas Aquinas, the most outstanding scholastic philosopher, who owed such profound debt to the thinkers of Muslim Spain, described Islam as nothing but a construct to accommodate the lust of Muhammad. Christian voices such as those of Dante and Aquinas can be glimpsed from Thomas Carlyle's historic lecture on the hero as prophet, Muhammad in Islam, in the series entitled On Heroes, Hero Worship, and the Heroic in History. Writing in mid-19th century, Carlyle urged his fellow Christians to, quote, dismiss our current hypothesis that Muhammad, that he was a scheming imposter, a falsehood incarnate, that his religion is a mere quackery and fatuity. No religious person in the history of the world has been maligned the way the Prophet of Islam has been maligned, and this is something that the Muslims are exceedingly sensitive to. Now, what has happened since September 11, particularly in the American media, is a total demonization of Islam and Muslims. Now, I am aware, of course, of the fact that the president and some members of the higher administration have made a great effort to point out that this war is not against Islam and it's not against Muslims. At the same time, if one watches television, even for a few minutes, and I can give you 1,000 examples of what has been shown in the, on the television since September 11th, these words ring very hollow. Now the question that arises in this context is, how are Muslim women to react to this? Afghan women, about which many of us are very deeply concerned and have been concerned for a long time, are, after all, Muslim women. The question that I would like now to ponder is the question of the quandary, really, of Muslim women faced with the current situation in the world today. Now, as I have indicated earlier, I have myself been engaged through much of my life in a struggle against patriarchalism in Muslim culture. This has been the greatest struggle of my own life. And I'm very well aware of the discrepancy that exists in so many areas between the normative teachings of Islam, which uphold human rights, which are very, very protective of the rights of women, and what is actually happening. And in fact, in the last 3 years, one of the causes that I have dedicated a lot of energy is to fighting honor crimes that are taking place in many countries, especially in my country of origin, Pakistan. So I am aware of that. And I have no desire to be apologetic in my approach and be defensive and say these things don't happen. They do happen. At the same time, I think it is very, very important to understand what is being done to misrepresent Islam and what is the impact of that. Now, let me say a few words about the use of language, about certain words that are being used. And let me begin by referring to the word fundamentalism, which is used all the time. Now, this word fundamentalism comes from the history of American evangelical Protestant Christianity. In the 1930s, there was a group of Christian believers who called themselves the fundamentalists. And their position was that if you are a Christian, you believe in certain fundamentals, and if you don't believe in them, then it was their duty to make you believe. Now, the characteristics, the two dominant characteristics of the fundamentalist movement were, A, that this movement was militant, and secondly, that it was literalistic in its interpretation of the text or the scriptures. So that was how this word originated. And it was used that way for a long time, but in the late 70s and 80s, fundamentalism came to be used as a generic term, and so we hear about the rise of Islamic fundamentalism and Jewish and Hindu and so on and so on. Now, what I would like to submit for your consideration is the fact that this word is entirely inappropriate in the context of Islam. There is no word in any Islamic language that corresponds to the word fundamentalism. If one looks at the Oxford English Dictionary, the word fundamental, or the word fundamentalist, means, or it's, the dictionary tells us, that a fundamentalist is a person who believes in the fundamentals of something. That's what the word fundamentalist means. Okay? Now, if someone were to ask me, are you a fundamentalist? Are you a Muslim fundamentalist? I would say yes. Why? Why do you say that? Because I believe in God, I believe in the prophets, I believe in the sacred books, I believe in the Day of Judgment, I believe in Islamic ethical principles. Well, no, I didn't really mean that, you know. What I really wanted to ask was, you know, are you an extremist? I mean, really, are you a terrorist? This is not what the word fundamentalist means. But this is how it has come to be applied. So the average person, average Muslim, who doesn't know about the evangelical Christian Protestants of the 1930s and their brand of fundamentalism, doesn't know that this word is being totally taken out of context. So I, for one, in my theology, refuse to use this word.
I win. Okay? You're listening to Dr. Rifat Hassan, feminist theologian at the University of Kentucky, speaking last week at a forum for Afghan women, promoting their inclusion in a new Afghan government. We'll come back to this speech in just a minute here on the War and Peace Report. Women of the World, Mahotella Queens, here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we go back to Dr. Rifat Hassan, feminist theologian at the University of Kentucky, speaking last week at the City University of New York, part of a conference called Women for Afghan Women, Securing Our Future. Dr. Rifat Hassan.
One other word that I want to talk about is the word jihad, which is being bandied about. Everybody in this country knows what jihad is. Jihad comes from the root word jahada, which means to struggle, to make actually an extraordinary effort. To me, jihad is the essence of Islam, okay? Because Islam is a religion of extraordinary effort. If you look at all the so-called pillars of Islam, prayers 5 times a day, siyam, fasting in the month of Ramadan, sharing your wealth, going for pilgrimage, standing up for the truth, testifying to the truth, standing up for justice, taking care of disadvantaged people, all of these tasks require an extraordinary ongoing effort. Okay. The Quran tells us that there are two kinds of jihad, the higher and the lower, or the greater and the lesser. The greater jihad is jihad fil nafs, jihad al-akbar, jihad against oneself, to make oneself a better person, because the assumption is that if you want to make the world a better place, you have to start by making yourself a better person. So that is the greater form of jihad. The lesser form of jihad is against external obstacles which are deemed to be antisocial or anti-God, things that are harmful to people or society. And one form of jihad, one form that jihad in this sense can take is war. But the only kind of war that is permitted in Islam, in the Quran, is defensive war. All the wars in which the Prophet of Islam took place were defensive wars. There is no place in Islam for aggression or wars of aggression. I'm not saying Muslims have never fought these wars. I'm talking to you about normative teachings of Islam, which are totally forgotten in the rhetoric of today. Now, jihad is such an integral concept, it's so integral to Islam, that I, for one, refuse to abandon it, even though I know how badly misused this word is. It's been translated not only as war, but as holy war. Now, there are two major kinds of wars that we talk about. We talk about just war, and we talk about holy war. Just war is a war that's in which the parties engaging believe they have a just cause, but these wars are fought within the parameters of reason, which means if you think you're going to lose, you don't engage in it, even if you have just cause. On the other hand, Holy war is a war in which you engage regardless of the consequences. You fight it for God or for some absolute truth, and you fight until the end. There is no concept of holy war in Islam. The Quran says if you engage in war and you feel that you're going to be defeated, you retreat. Islam is a religion that the Quran puts tremendous emphasis on the use of reason. Thousands of times it says, think about it. Reason is what elevates human beings, not only above the animals, as the Greeks said, but above the celestial creatures, above the angels. So there's tremendous emphasis on the use of reason. So indeed, now, there is holy war, but is holy war the translation of the word jihad? I submit that it is not. Holy war is a translation of the word crusade, which was fought by Christian kings in the Middle Ages to free the Holy Land from so-called infidels who happen to be Muslims. So let's be clear about whose holy war it is that we are talking about. Now, I would like to, why I am saying that is because why I felt that it was necessary to contextualize this. I get your message. Why I think it was so important to say this is because now the after many years of the tremendous suffering on the part of Afghan women, a time is coming when there is a chance that their destiny might change and they may have an opportunity to really shape the future of their country. This is a very special a time of great opportunity that must be seized properly. George Santayana said, those who do not know their history are destined to repeat it. What I would like to say to my Afghan sisters here, and to my Afghan sisters who are not here, but this is my message basically to them, and that is the following. After the Iranian Revolution, both superpowers of that time, the US and the USSR, were terrified of the spread of so-called Islamic fundamentalism. Again, I use the word under duress. I don't want to use this word. The Soviet Union reacted by direct action in Afghanistan, which led to a 10-year war. And what the Western countries and the US did was it started to create, it did a lot of things, but one of the significant things it did, that it started to create within Islamic countries a lot of women's NGOs, organizations, human rights organizations that they deemed to be anti-Islamic. Because their idea was that the only way to stop the spread of so-called Islamic fundamentalism is to fund these people who are anti-Islamic fundamentalists. And this has happened. In fact, it's something we really need to be looking at, is that fundamentalists of both kinds, the religious and the anti-religious, have been very heavily funded by the West and very heavily funded by this country. Okay, now this effort to create this alternate, which was anti-religious, has been totally counterproductive. Why? Because Muslims, all Muslims of the world, including Afghan people, including Afghan women, are believers in God. They are religious people. They believe in God, although they express their religion in very many different ways. Not all Muslims pray 5 times a day, not all Muslims fast, etc. But Muslims, by and large, overwhelming majority of them, have a very strong belief in God, and they do believe in the Islamic value system. And when someone comes along and says, Islam and human rights are incompatible, and I have a lot of sources here, which if maybe later on I have time, these are articles that came out this week, and one came out in Time magazine, and I do not know why this article actually quotes me, because I think this article is totally wrong in the statement that it's making against Islam. But there is this idea that, this school of thought says, I mean, we have, what's the general picture here is like this. In Muslim countries, in general, Pakistan is the country I know best, and I can cite Pakistan, but this is happening all over the world. There is the extreme religious right, who are very narrow and bigoted and very conservative. Now, I don't put Taliban in this category, because for Taliban, there is no historical parallel. They're outside the frame of reference. I'm not talking about Taliban. I'm talking about religious extremists who are a different category of people. Now, these people deny that women have any problems. They think all Muslim women are treated like princesses and queens, and they don't have to work, and they're taken care of, and what business is it of the UN to interfere in their affairs? So my problem with them is that the vast majority of Muslim women, maybe over 400, 500 million human beings, do not live like princesses and queens. They live in subhuman conditions, and this is something that needs to be confronted. The other, I have actually, according to my watch, 5 more minutes. I wouldn't be standing here if I wasn't, right? Now, the other side, this other group of people who say Islam and human rights are incompatible, what I have to say to them is, first of all, anyone who says Islam and human rights are incompatible has never read the Quran, because every single right there is in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, there is in the Quran, and I can give you chapter and verse. The second point is a pragmatic point. You know, I have devoted so many years of my life to this struggle for to promote the rights of Muslim women, because I care very much for that woman who really is faceless and nameless and voiceless, who lives in a village, who's poor, who's illiterate. She is the woman I would like to reach. The rich and the elite and the educated women can take care of themselves. I'm not so worried about them. How do I reach this woman? How do I access this woman? Can I say to this woman who lives in a village in Egypt or Ankara or anywhere, I bring you liberation in the name of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights 1948. Now, I'm not knocking this document. I think it's a great document. I have great respect for it. What I'm saying is it's not relevant to her life. Okay? But if I say to her, you believe in God, and she does, God is the sustaining factor in the lives of these women. God has been the sustaining factor in the lives of millions of Afghan women as they have faced every kind of hell. So God is very central to their lives. And I said, do you believe that God is Rahim and Rahman, just and compassionate and merciful? Do you believe that? And she believes that. Then do you think that this God wants it, that you should be brutalized and killed and die in childbirth? This is very simple theology, but it makes sense to her. A light goes on in her eyes and she says, she begins to see that this religion, which has always been the sustaining force of her life, can become also a means of empowerment. It has been used to restrict her, but it can become a means of empowerment. This is the only tool, in fact, that she has in most Islamic countries to do anything with it. So this changes her whole life. Now, the question is now, and let me say this again for the record. I this takes a long, much longer time, and I have to finish now. Unfortunately, I was having a little bit more time, but anyway. Okay.
Yeah, it's fine.
Thank you. Okay. Since the 1970s, we notice that when the process of Islamization starts, which is the imposition of Islamic laws by the governments of the country, starting with Iran and Pakistan and Malaysia and Sudan and Algeria, and most recently, of course, in its strangest form in Afghanistan. One common feature that we see is that once a law, any law, has been promulgated in any of these countries in the name of Islam, it has never been reversed. Not in the last 30 years. There's not one example of the law being reversed. Despite the fact that women's groups are one of the most active, in many countries, the most active groups of any political group in the Muslim world. This is a fact that a lot of Western people either don't know or they don't want to recognize it, but this is a fact, that they are very active Muslim movements, women's movements, in virtually every Muslim country. So political action, on the basis of empirical evidence, I would say, that political action is not sufficient. It's necessary. It has some limited efficacy, but it's not sufficient. It doesn't roll back the laws. So what does this mean now? What this means is that in all Muslim countries, the discourse now of political language, of culture, of identity, is in Islamic terms. Okay? It's in Islamic terms. This question sometimes of should it be this way or should it not be this way is a very interesting academic question, but it's totally irrelevant because this is how it is, that the language is Islamic. And if one wants to struggle for one's human rights, one has to have the ability to engage in the discourse of Islam. Now, I have been saying this for years to people who I thought could do something about it, to the State Department people, to the foreign ministry people in the government of Holland, with whom I have been doing a lot of projects, saying, you know, let's try to educate Afghan women, at least those who are living outside of Afghanistan, millions of them living in refugee camps in Pakistan, let us educate them about their rights in Islam. Because sooner or later, whenever the opportunity comes, they are going to have to fight for their rights in Islamic terms. And if they don't know these terms, they're going to be left out of the picture. And they thought that was a great idea, and nobody did anything about it. So I am repeating that again, that this, it, at this very critical juncture, where these new negotiations are being started, that we are still back at that same point, that unless Afghan women acquire the ability to enter into this discourse, it doesn't matter if it's not the Taliban, if it's the Northern Alliance, no matter who it is, and no matter which country it is actually even, it doesn't even have to be Afghanistan. That is how it is. That because now the whole question of identity revolves around the question of Islam. And so this is, I think, I end with my two or three recommendations. What needs to be done? First of all, what does the U.S. women's movement want to do in support of Afghan women? As Rina Amiri wrote a very good article a couple of days ago in New York Times, very good article. She says, Western people, and especially Western women's groups, need to have a much better understanding of what true Islam really, or progressive Islam really is. Because they cannot keep on going on identifying Islam in the way that the media is demonizing Islam and looking at Islam in a totally distorted fashion. If you really want to help Afghan women, you have to understand that religion, which is the matrix of their life, in which their life is rooted. So that is one number one. That is the big challenge now. Because you see, we can go about constructing a paradigm of liberation in many ways. We can say, we are the Western women, we have the best paradigm of liberation, and we want you to be not like them, but like us, so you do what we do. This is not going to happen. This is a total illusion. Because no group, no community can create a paradigm of human rights outside of its fundamental framework of beliefs. So Muslim women are going to create that paradigm within the framework of their belief system. And this is something that has to be accepted, and accepted with good grace. So I'm very hopeful that at least the people who are gathered here, who have been so supportive of Afghan women, that they will have that generosity of spirit and heart and mind to understand this and to promote it, and to say, we want to support you, Afghan sisters, to achieve liberation on your terms and not on our terms.
Dr. Rifat Hassan, professor of the Religious Studies Program at University of Louisville, Kentucky, writes about religious conservatism and feminist theology as a means of combating injustice toward women in Islam countries as well. If you'd like to order a video cassette copy of this program, you can call 1-800-926-3921. That's 1-800-926-3921. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, with Lizzie Ratner and Suganya Mahendran. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. We're broadcasting at WBIX.org as well as democracynow.org and Web Active. Thanks to Amy Parmelo at KPFA and KFCF and all the folks at KPFA, all the Pacifica affiliates who are airing our program around the country. We are Pacifica. We're broadcasting from downtown community television and on Dish Network Channel 9415, as well as CUNY TV. Broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, the studios of the Band and the Fire, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.